welcome, Chair. Do you need some I think what we'll do is we'll get the one on the employment equity, and then we'll deal with the issues there, and then go to the one on employment services, just so that we do not muddle and confuse the issues. Thank you. The chair will be chairing in the meantime.
Thank you, Chair. We'll take the members, Chair, through the reports. We're not going to spend a lot of time, Chair, on the areas where there's an agreement on. We'll spend more time on the areas where there's disagreements on at NEDLAC. On the areas where there's agreement, we will deal with them, but not as extensive as the areas where there's disagreement. To explain what are the disagreements, what are the issues. On the areas where there's an agreement on the issues, we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. And on the employment equity, and Twaki Mamashela, who is the employment equity director at NEDLAC, and who also was part of the team negotiating the amendment, who will do the presentation. And on the employment services bill, DDG Sam will do the presentation. Thank you, Twaki.
Thank you very much, honorable members and honorable chairperson. Maybe I need to just outline that we have linked the presentation to the NEDLAC report so that it's easier. And the objective why we are amending the proposed the Employment Equity Act is threefold, because we wanted to make sure that we give effect to the fundamental constitutional rights, the right to equality, fair labor practices, and protection against unfair discrimination as per the Constitution Clause 9.2, which deals with equality issues. And the second one is that we wanted to strengthen the implementation and enforcement mechanisms in the current Employability Act. For example, we are all increasing the fines for non-compliance. The Act has not been revised or amended since 1998, and now it's 15 years since the inception of the Act. And the third objective is that as signatories to the International Labour Organization, the country has ratified Convention 100 that deals with equal pay for work of equal value, and Convention 111 that deals with the elimination of unfair discrimination in all. And we've been receiving reports because we are expected as the country to submit annual reports or every second year a report giving progress in terms of how the South African government together with its social partners are actually giving effect to these two conventions in terms of our national law. So we wanted to make sure that our laws are aligned with our international obligations and the standards. So in this amendment, we have tried to actually make sure that we achieve all these three objectives through one set of amendments that we are putting before Parliament today. if you look at the current act, we have now clarified the designated group. We have revised this definition to ensure that we are clear who are the beneficiaries of affirmative action. We all know that affirmative action in terms of Chapter 3 was introduced to address the imbalances and of the past and to make sure that all the groups that were previously disadvantaged get access to equal opportunities of training, of promotion, and career advances in the workplace. Therefore, this definition has been revised and amended to make sure that we understand that beneficiaries of affirmative action are limited to persons who were citizens of South Africa before the democratic era, that is the 27th April 1994, honorable members, and their descendants, because they were disadvantaged due to apartheid law. So this definition was agreed by all social partners at NEDLAC. And it's aligned also to the current amendments that have gone through Parliament now on the BBB, the Broad Black-Based Economic Empowerment Act. So this is aligned with making sure that all the transformation legislation is aligned. Another area that has been agreed with all social partners is that in addition to the current prohibited grounds under Chapter 2, Section 6.1, we have prohibited grounds that emanate from the Constitution that there shouldn't be any unfair discrimination on any of the prohibited grounds like race, gender, pregnancy, sex, birth. All that we did there and agreed with social partners is that we need to add another ground, which is any arbitrary ground. I'll expand that. Any arbitrary ground is in instances where we are both African females, there's no race issue there. How we are doing the same job. However, for whatever reason, the supervisor might decide that although we perform the same, we have the same qualifications and expertise, that the other African female would earn higher than the other African female because the other one is beautiful, the other one is ugly, or the other one has got long hair, and the other one has got short hair. I'm just trying to explain what we mean about arbitrary. Hence, we agreed as social partners that the arbitrary grounds also cannot be allowed as part of the prohibited unfair discrimination. And we'll expand on the onus of the proof, how we're going to deal with the arbitrary grounds versus the prohibited grounds when we deal with Section 11 that deals with the burden of proof. How do you prove your unfair discrimination on all these grounds? So this was agreed. I'm not spending a lot of time there. Another new provision which allows the country or the government as a whole to comply with our international obligation is the issue of equal pay for work of equal value. And a new section has been introduced, which is Section 4, that deals explicitly with unfair discrimination by employers in respect of terms and conditions of employment of employees doing the same work or work of similar or work of equal value, and the differences in pay or conditions between employees performing the same or work of the substantially the same value will amount to unfair discrimination unless the employer can show that the differences were fair in relation to experience, skill, responsibility, qualifications, or the size of the portfolios that people manage, the complexity of the jobs. We are saying here that we know there will always be salary differentiation, but there must be justifiable reasons why there is differentiation in salary. We've been around and tested it with a number of JSE-listed companies, and some of them have admitted to race and gender disparities without any justifiable reasons, and they are putting measures in place to rectify the salaries that are not the same. And this was agreed with all social partners that we need this clause. Another additional clause to give effect to the equal pay for work of equal value that was added is a new clause, is Section challenges, how we evaluate work of Equal Value. Because the challenge is that we need to know the criteria and the factors that we are going to take into account when we say people that are doing similar work are actually contributing equal value in terms of performance, the skill and expertise that are required. And in terms of this area, 6.5, work has started within the Commission for Employment Equity together with the department, with the technical assistance of the ILO. We have started, we have done a literature review of international best practices to see which other countries are doing better in terms of equal pay for work of equal value. This is a new concept in South Africa and in Africa as a whole. The best practices that we could pick up in the literature review, Honourable Chair, that we can also share with the Parliament or the committees, that in the UK they are doing better. However, they are only looking at gender components, that there should be fairness between the pay paid to females and men. They are not looking at other grounds like race, pregnancy, as listed in our constitution and in Section 8. So it becomes a little bit complex for our South African context, because we have a number of prohibited grounds based on the legacy of the laws that were in place, the background, the history that we are carrying with us. So we are making progress to make sure that when the law is promulgated, all the regulations and the guidelines how to implement this section are in place. This area deals with psychometric testing. Here is just a technical amendment, Honourable Members. We are saying that currently the law Section 8 allows psychometric and similar tests to be done for assessment of employees before they can be employed. The only area that we are adding is that you can only use psychometric tests and similar assessments to assess applicants for a job if those tests and assessments have been certified by a Health Professions Council of South Africa, which is the only professional body in the country at the moment that is certified by law to actually give accreditation to this kind of assessment. And we are saying also that there may later on be another body which is authorized to certify such tests. Meaning that if you are authorized, there must be a legislation backing up your authorization besides the professional council. This was agreed that we should leave it open so that should there be any developments in this area, we are covered. This is an area where we are saying we are trying to protect the constitutional rights to equality and make access to justice easy for people that are vulnerable in terms of unfair discrimination. So in this section, we are amending Section 10.6, where we are dealing with the cases that are referred to the CCMA. And we are saying that currently the law says that the CCMA can only conciliate. They cannot arbitrate. But here we are saying that there are two circumstances where the CCMA needs power to arbitrate on unfair discrimination cases. If the employee's course of action arises from allegation of sexual harassment, irrespective of whether you are an executive, a manager or a senior manager or a sweeper or a cleaner, if you are sexually harassed, you can take your case to CCMA for arbitration, and the CCMA needs to give an arbitration award. And we are saying for lower paid employees, those earning less than the BCA threshold, which is sitting at 183,000 currently, which is being revised constantly by the Employment Conditions Commission, is that if you have been discriminated on any grounds listed under Section 6.1, you can actually approach the CCMA for arbitration. So we are giving access to the most vulnerable groups to justice in terms of the CCMA. And this was agreed by all social partners. This is the section that we'll have to pause a bit on in terms of how we're going to deal with all the listed grounds in terms of the burden of proof. Who is required to actually prove there was unfair discrimination? First thing that we did in terms of Section 11 is that we are bringing consistency with the approach and provisions of the PEPFUDA. This is the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act that came into place in 2000. The Employment Equity Act was enacted in 1998. So this issue is dealt with differently under Section 13 of PEPFUDA, the Equality Act. So we agreed that we need to bring some alignment with other pieces of legislation dealing with equality. However, there is a bit of differentiation when coming up with unfair discrimination cases. If unfair discrimination is alleged on any of the prohibited grounds, like race, gender, HIV status, disability, pregnancy, marital status, the employer must prove on a balance of probabilities that the discrimination did not take place, or it was rational, or it was not unfair, and they must give justifiable reasons for that. However, if you look at the issue of arbitrary grounds, because the employer may not necessarily be aware that we are two African females contributing work of equal value, and the other one is getting a higher notch, and the is getting a lesser notch because she's not bright in color, not beautiful enough, and this one is beautiful. We are saying the complainant will then have to prove on the balance of probabilities that conduct of the employer was not rational, and it tantamount to discrimination and unfair discrimination to actually discriminate the two African females that are contributing to work of equal pay. So this was agreed that that's why I'm spending a little bit of time that the onus, the burden of proof changes when we come to arbitrary grounds. But there is agreement on that one. This area of the Employment Equity Plan, we have agreed on all other areas except the section that is new that we have inserted, that all designated employers who fail to prepare and implement their e-plan can be referred directly to the Labour Court by the Director General for a fine, without first securing an undertaking or issuing a compliance order by the Labour Inspector. There is a disagreement in this area with business. Business feel that the status quo should remain. We should first allow the Labour Inspector to secure a written undertaking, and if the employer still doesn't have a plan, then we should give them a 60 days to with the compliance order, which is cumbersome. We believe that an e-plan is a roadmap. It's just like any business plan that companies have. This is an imperative. If you have an intention to transform your organization, the Employment Equity Plan should be a priority. And it should be integrated in your own business plan. Therefore, there's no need to secure a written undertaking or a compliance order. If you don't have a plan, or you have it and you are failing to reach all the targets that you set yourself to achieve, we need to give the Director General powers to refer the matter to the Labour Court to impose the fine. And business, this is an area where we are differing with business. Organized labour and government agree on this issue. It's only business that disagrees. On other areas under Section 20, we are removing occupational categories because it deals with people studying in the same field of study. We can all be studying in education, but we become teachers. We are actually not managers, if you look at it horizontally. We are deleting that because transformation and empowerment has to do with decision-making power, which is at its occupational level. Where are you sitting in the hierarchy of the organization? What powers do you have in terms of influencing the strategies and the decisions that are taken in organizations? So we have agreed on that one. In Section 21, we have agreed that there will be no differentiation in terms of reporting. Currently, the law says that small employers that employ less than 150 employees they can report every second year. Those that employ 150 and more employees must submit reports on an annual basis on the first working day of October. We've been requested by small business themselves that we should make changes. They insist on submitting reports annually, even if they are not required to submit. They say it's cumbersome to keep records for 24 months. So we have agreed with social partners that we should actually go for all employers reporting on an annual basis. And on the issue of failure to submit an e-report, we have agreed that if you don't submit the report as required by law, Section 21, you should actually allow the DG to send a letter to the Labour Court for a fine without securing an undertaking or a compliance code. The issue of income differentials, we're just adding the element in terms of the measures to eliminate unfair discrimination in relation to terms and conditions of employment, so that we give effect to equal pay for work of equal value that I've already alluded to under clauses 6.4 and 6.5. And this was agreed with all social partners. Here we had a glitch at NetLab with business again. We are trying to strengthen the enforcement mechanisms of this act. It's 15 years and the progress has been very slow. In terms of the current law, Section 86 is that the inspectors will secure a written undertaking. If you fail to comply, they will come back after 60 days and give you a compliance order. So we are saying here there should be securing of written undertaking for certain sections of the law, except Section 20 that deals with the plan and the report, which must be direct referral. However, business believes that we should leave the current sections as they are to ensure that we give employers a chance to do the plan and to implement the plan. And we are saying with organized labor as the government that we need to shorten the cumbersome process of enforcement and expedite transformation. So this is an area that will give us challenges when dealing with the public hearing. And it continues because if you don't comply with the compliance order in terms of Section 37, then you still have an opportunity to object to your compliance order in terms of Section 39. And we are saying that section should be repealed. Because if you don't comply with the compliance order, why should you now object to the same compliance order? And Section 40 also says if you are still not happy with the DG's decision on your objection, you can still appeal to comply with the compliance order. And we are saying Section 39 and Section 40 should actually be repealed and be removed from the laws to simplify and eliminate unnecessary steps in the enforcement mechanisms of the Act. And again, business disagree with government and organized labor on this matter. They want the status quo to remain. In terms of Section 42, this was an agreement that we'll actually do technical amendments to give employers an opportunity to raise any reasonable grounds to justify why they have not complied. And another provision that we agreed with was that the minister will issue regulations giving guidance to employers how to deal with the economically active population in terms of national versus regional EAP. We call it the EAP abbreviation for economically active population. We have seen in the news the cases that are sitting in the labor court in terms of the correctional services in the Western Cape versus the colors that were not promoted. Is that issue of correctional services using the national demographics of the economically active population, and the argument that Solidarity is putting forward is that they should take into account the Western Cape economically active population where colors are sitting at 52%. And we are saying for reaching agreement, we have agreed that there will be guidelines issued by the minister in consultation with all parties that we make sure that we give proper guidance how to take into account the national or regional economically active population. And I must say, honourable members, work has started within the commission and the department to look at options of how we can start developing these guidelines and put them as part of the amendments to the employment equity regulation to support this provision. Section 45 was amended to make sure that in terms of the Director General review processes, which we have tested as the department on behalf of the Director General, at times we get challenges when we request information, employers are refusing to give us information to assess if they are complying, and the agreement at NETLAG was that if employers fail to give us the information requested by the Director General, the Director General will have 90 days before we can refer the matter to the Labour Court to force the employers to give us the information as requested. And at times when we issue recommendations for non-compliance, some employers do not comply with those recommendations. So the agreement was that from the date of issue or from the date where the employer failed to comply with the recommendations, the DG has got 120 days to refer the matter to the Labour Court so that the Labour Court can force the employer to comply or impose the fine. So this was agreed with all social partners. The next one as well does give more powers now in terms of Section 48 to the arbitrators at the CCMA that they should be able to hear unfair discrimination claims and make arbitration awards, in particular to address the protection of the vulnerable workers. And Section 50 also is just a technical amendment which was agreed to that we need to bring alignment with the pieces of legislation dealing with promotion of administrative justice that was issued in 2000. So this is not a complicated area. It was agreed with all social partners. In terms of the Section 53.5, a new insertion has been made there to ensure that the minister can make a code of good practice dealing with the assessment of whether employers are complying with the Act for the purpose of awarding state contracts. I must say, honourable members, that this Section 53 was never promulgated because while we're looking at mechanisms of giving effect to this provision, that the BEE Act was introduced with its code. There was a little bit of overlap, which we are now trying to address in terms of the amendments that have gone through Parliament, the alignment. So this area was also agreed with social partners. In terms of Section 55 to the Minister, here is also a technical amendment. The current Act forces the Minister to have two separate forms for large and small employers. And what we did there was to just amend the must to may to make sure that the Minister's got discretionary powers to make simplified rules and procedures for employers that employ fewer than 150 employees in relation to reporting requirements, and this was agreed with all social partners. And as we speak, honourable members, we are busy looking at the reporting forms to simplify them further and to make sure that we simplify our reporting system. We have an online reporting system which is less cumbersome in terms of making sure that employers can report through internet without doing any paperwork, so it will lessen the burden on both large and small employers. And this simplified forms will also go through the NETLAG structures for endorsement. The delegation of powers as well here, this is just a technical amendment where we are saying that the minister needs to be able to delegate powers maybe to the Director General in terms of issuing certificates of compliance where people want to access state contracts. It's linked to Section 53. Because the current Act says that in terms of issuing certificate of compliance, it's only the minister that can do that. But if you look at other provisions, the Director General is responsible for operations and enforcing the law. So we are saying the law should be flexible in terms of the minister delegating powers further to the Director General. The issue of Section 50, 7 was just amended to align it to the LRA in terms of temporary employment services. And it's still a debate around this issue. However, we thought we'll flag it out that it looks like it will be 3 months. And we are saying that for the purpose of affirmative action, employees who are placed with a temporary employment service with a client for longer than 3 months will be deemed to be employees of that client. Therefore, if we can pay service, yeah, I understand that the bill still says 6 months. Yeah. No, that's why I said there's still no agreement, and my boss, my chief is saying that the bill still says 6 months, but this is still under debate. I don't want us to, it will change depending on the outcome of the parliament, honourable members. So we'll come back and amend it accordingly. Okay, honourable chairperson, we'll amend section 57 just to bring that alignment with the LRA when it comes through parliament. And if I may, I'm about to finalize a chairperson, if you allow me. The criminal penalties. There are sections in the law in terms of section 59 and section 61 that the minute the employer provides the department with falsified information, it becomes fraudulent activity, the criminal activity which must be dealt with the criminal, the justice system. And there was always a fine of 10,000 that needs to be imposed, which has never changed for 15 years. And it was agreed to social partners that this fine should actually be moved to 30,000. And we should also amend a provision that says that our Minister of Labour must first get concurrence with the Minister of Justice before we can actually increase this penalty to counter the inflation. So we are saying we are just making sure that it's easy, that those criminal activities must be dealt with. We have seen it as we are going around that some employers have 2E plans, the one that they, and 2E reports, the one that they submit to the department and the one that they use for BE. So those reports should be the same because that is fraudulent. You have one for the Department of Labor, one for BE scoring of points to access tenders. So we are trying to cap all those criminal activities. In terms of adjustment of annual turnover, I need to just explain that there is a new section to empower the ministers that is inserted as section 64A, where we are saying the minister can adjust the annual turnover threshold in Schedule 4. I'll explain to Schedule 4 now in the Act, dealing with those employers that are designated because of their turnover, not their number of employees. There are employers that have less than 50 employees, but in terms of the turnover that they are making, they are also required to comply with the provisions of affirmative action. So this was agreed to. Before I get to Schedule 4, we need to pause a bit and look at the increase in funds. We are saying we are trying to fast-track transformation. It has been 15 years since the enactment of the Act, and the fines that are in Schedule 1 have never changed. The maximum fine, if you keep on not complying, is 900,000. It's less than a million. Now we have discussed this at length, like I said, there must be an adjustment to the maximum fines that may be imposed for contravention with the Act, to reflect the change in the value of money. It's 15 years now, people are actually budgeting for this fund. As we go around and doing the DG reviews, we get stories where we are told that they actually budget for this fund because they are less than a million. Catch me if you can so that I have the money to pay the fund. And in addition to that, we are saying the employer's turnover may be taken into account in determining the maximum fine that may be imposed for substantive failures to comply with the Act. I need to explain the disagreement with organized business. They don't want the fines to be linked to turnover. Because turnover is not profit. We are dealing with turnover of the whole company. If you are a big company, mining company, for instance, for example, Anglo Platinum, and you are 2% of your turnover, and your turnover runs into billions, they believe it's a lot of money. And we are saying, if your heart and your mind is in the right place to address the imbalances of the past and to embrace diversity and reconciliation as we are pushing in the country, you shouldn't fear the fine, because you must do the right thing and comply with the law. And we have just summarized to bring it closer to the honorable members how the fines have been revised and structured. We have fines for procedural compliance. If you are not consulting in terms of Section 16, which is just consultation, consulting your employees is an easy thing that you can do. You can put a forum or use the workplace forum that is in existence to consult on issues of employment decrees, which is procedural. And letters for consultation, which is Section 17, you must consult your employees in terms of your workplace audit and analysis that you have conducted. You must actually consult them on the e-plan and consult them on the e-report before you submit it to the Director General. And we are saying, if you are found for not having done that with these procedural issues of Section 16, 17, 19 that deals with the analysis, Section 22 deals with an obligation that if you are a private sector company, you must publish a summary of the employment equity report in your annual financial report. We are saying that is procedural. We have in the regulations a template that you can use, and why are you not publishing your profile? So it's an issue that we are saying, if you are, if the first contravention, it will be 1.5 million. We are increasing it. Now, those are proposed fines. However, we are saying on Section 20, which is the e-plan, the roadmap to transform your organization, and the report to give us progress on how you are transforming your organization, and Section 23, that deals with successive employment equity plans, and failure to comply to the DG recommendations, we are saying that the court should actually find you anything greater than 1.5 million or 2% of the employer's turnover. That's where the problem is with organized labor. Organized business. Excuse me. Labor and government are together with the fund. Only business hates the concept of turnover. And it continues up. On the next slide, we are highlighting that if you are a perpetual non-compliant employer, and this is what we are proposing, then it should actually be the greater of 2.7 million or 10% of the employer's turnover if you don't submit your report, if you don't have an equity plan, and if you fail to comply with the Director General recommendations that give you an opportunity to comply. So it can actually increase to 10% of turnover. The last one is the Schedule 4. That deals with those that are lower, they have fewer than 50 employees, but their turnover is higher in terms of the sectors that they are operating in. We are saying we are increasing Schedule 4 with 200%, and this was agreed with all employers. And we are saying thereafter the minister can actually increase it to counter the inflation. The lowest sector in terms of the increase that we have is the agricultural sector. We are saying anyone in the agricultural sector that employs less than 50 employees but their annual turnover is equal to 6 million or less, they don't have to actually comply because they are then very small. But those that have a turnover of 6 million and above, they must comply with affirmative action clauses under Chapter 3. And this summarizes the areas of agreement at NEDLAC and areas of disagreement. Remember what I said, the Section 20, the direct referral to a failure to have an e-plan, organized business doesn't want it. The shortening of the enforcement mechanisms in terms of Section 36, 37, they don't want that, they still want the place of call of you securing the undertaking and the compliance of. The repealing of Section 39, the objections to compliance order, Section 40, the appeal to compliance order, organized business don't agree, they want the status quo to remain. And the Schedule 1, organized business doesn't agree with the turnover concept, but they agree with all other provisions. We thought we'll just summarize the areas so that it's easy when you look at the NetLeg report. And thank you very much for the opportunity, Honorable Member. Our presentation is done. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. I don't know if honorable members would want to make reflections, ask specific questions, bearing in mind that the purpose is to give a background for the public hearings, which will be starting tomorrow. And just to welcome honorable Panagostes and honorable Makubele Mashela, who has come in and out. Hopefully she's coming back. She's coming back. She's fresh from the from observing the elections. The free and peaceful elections. Yeah. Okay. I don't have any reflections.
Thanks, Chairperson. So fundamentally, the areas of disagreement. Excuse me. Is the not so much the actual laws itself, but more the enforcement mechanisms and the increasing in fines, and these, except of course for Section 20, which is failure to prepare and implement an EU plan. So it seems to me that business doesn't disagree with the laws; they just disagree with being caught breaking the laws. So I mean that's a bit dodgy, if you ask my opinion. Did they have any justifiable, did they try to justify this in any way? Was there anything that they could say, we know it's against the law to kill people, but if you catch us, please don't, you know, sentence us to more than 10 weeks in prison or something. You know, so I just want to know, it seems that they don't mind the law, but they do mind what happens to them if they get, or when they get caught breaking that law. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Williams. Just a reminder that everybody will be appearing before the committee, so we can still ask them. Yes. Okay. Honorable Patel.
Thank you, Chair. Just my usual bugbear about NetLeg. I don't know how we do this, but at some point you've got to find a way of making sure that these guys who go to NetLeg don't get out of there until they've all agreed on everything. Because it's one of the, for me, the weakest part of our NetLeg process, is that where things become sticky, then they keep for touch. And then we almost seem to go over the same process again. In other words, those areas where they don't agree, they can walk out and say, you know, I think it's on work out. And that, in my view, weakens our NetLeg process, because that's really the forum where we should be having the hard issues resolved. So the hard issues actually get kicked out and say, okay, the politicians will deal with them. And for me, that's the unfortunate part, because if you take the German example of this kind of thing, it is the hard issues that they take to the authority. Where you need, for instance, a basic thing like, if we all agree that we need equity, then the three key partners should agree on it, and then we can butt heads about how we do it. It's just my comment on this thing, because I believe if we do that, then implementation becomes easy.
Honorable Chabane.
I just wanted to check if there are clashes between
the PC and some of the amendments that were making. Because there was something referring to the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. That's taking it 59. But just a little comment about the disagreements, Honorable Mutale, is that here there are issues of vested interest. Capital in this country has a history where they were making profits without regard to anything, lives and limbs of workers were not taken into cognizance. So obviously, if you start coming up with laws that if somebody loses a limb because the employer did not give this person protective clothing or the equipment are not up to scratch, that's leading to injury and all others, obviously they will resist because it's a safety at work. They are costly to those. The issues of timbering in the mines and upgrading of timber and other matters related to security. The mining magnates are not happy about this. But at the same time, there's a contradiction because you still need these workers tomorrow to come to work. But there are many out there who are queuing, you know, to actually start working right on the slippering on the blood of their fellow workers who just lost their limb an hour ago. So we have this negative history that will take a long time to go, where people will focus more on profits than lives and limbs of people. So it is understandable that then. And anyway, if you put workers and employers on the same table, it's not going to be easy, particularly to discuss fines, where employers have to be fined for not complying. So naturally, people will try to defend because they want to maximize their profits. So it is alright for NetLeg to refer matters here to us where there are no agreements. Otherwise, we'll never complete any negotiations anymore. And even in some of these agreements, if Member Sheila can attest to that, I think the agreements are based on sufficient consensus. Not that there is a vote that is 100% agreement. So it is the nature of negotiations, they go that way. And matters get referred to the principals when there are no agreements. So who are those principals? We are the principals to make not very popular decisions sometimes, but making what we think are good decisions to make in our endeavors to create a peaceful society where business can thrive and workers can go to work looking forward to going to work the following day. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can we hop one last one and first Hazel?
Thank you, Chairperson. The term equal value is one which I would love some more explanation on. If I think, for example, in education, you get primary school educators, you get secondary school educators, you get language educators, you get science teachers, for example. We do know that in education for many years they have said that they all, you know, perform the same important work, and therefore you may not discriminate between teachers that offer scarce subjects versus those where you find teachers more easily. Also, we do know that the pay progression depends on the number of years of service. We also know that pay is linked to the qualifications and the number of years of formal study, which has been accepted over many years as valuable means of discrimination, acceptable forms of discrimination in terms of salary. And my question is just, are we going into difficult territory when we speak of equal value, in terms of this law, when we're no longer looking at things like market forces? Because I do know at some private schools, if you are very good at, for example, get good results and so on at the end of the year, then they pay you more. If you come and you teach a subject where there's an abundance of people available in the market, in the labour market, to offer that subject, they may offer you a lower salary. So there are forces at play in the economy which don't, I think, always relate to value in terms of value in terms of output, but it may also be value in terms of market. How difficult would it be to attract such an employee? I can just imagine that this can be a very big debate, and that people can write thesis on what that means. And I'm just, I need to have clarity on this. I don't want us to go to court again, or have an employer being taken to court for the courts to determine what is the full implications of that term. So if you could just spell that out to us, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Bearing in mind that the concept of value in this context is a very philosophical context that we've been put. Okay. I think we have, I think, about four questions and some comments and observations.
Question of both of us. The first one on the issue whether is there any clash between other legislation and this. The only area that overlap is the area around temporal employees, the labour code, where she was saying 3 months. The deal, the employment equity, is still talked to 6 months. Obviously, if the LRA is voted tomorrow and it says, as it says now, then this has got to be in line with that. That's one area. On the issue of values, this is a concept that is accepted internationally. The International Labour Organization talks about equal pay for work of equal value. That's Convention 100. It's an internationally accepted principle. There's nothing new. We're not introducing new terrain here. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just taking what is out there in the labor market internationally. Now, the question that Honorable Member is asking is that, does this concept allow differentiation, basically? It's got nothing to do with the market, it's got about differentiation. If we do the same job between me and Swaki, we drive the same truck, called 14 truck. We drive the same distance from Cape Town, we deliver goods in Johannesburg. But in the month, I do 5 more trips than her. For whatever reason, whether she sleeps on the road, she drinks, whatever she does, but I do 5 more trips. Now, the value that we add in the organization is different, because I do more trips. It's accepted then that I'll add more than her. Although we're doing the same job, but the value that I'm adding in the organization is more, because I do 5 more trips. The same applies with education. If my performance as a teacher is such that in my classes, my students get 100% pass, they get 80% in maths, 80% in physics, and her students get lesser than that, she'll get lesser than me. If I've got a scheme in the labor market that the job needs, But obviously we've got to be very careful about the scheme. If we're going to drive a Volkswagen diesel, you need somebody who's got a code A. You don't need somebody who's got a code 4G to drive a diesel. Therefore you can't say, because I've got a code 4G, I must get more driving a diesel. The skill must be equal to the job. If the job needs a doctor, if that's the requirement of the job, and you've got the skills of a doctor, and I don't, you'll earn more than me. But if the job does not need a doctor, needs something else, you can't compensate for that skill, because that's not what the job needs. And that's how it's looked at on this issue. The concept of the value is not unique to South Africa. It's an international accepted acceptable concept. And there are exceptions, as I've said. It will depend on the skill, it will depend on the performance, it will depend on the availability of your skill. If your skill is scarce, the labor market accepts that, and this concept accepts that, and the skill that is needed. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Gandhi. I just wanted to comment on the BCA. The chairperson asked also on the BCA. The only area where we talking about the BCA threshold, there wouldn't be a clash. It's the issue of unfair discrimination cases that will be referred by anybody that ends below the BCA threshold of 183,000 as it stands currently. As the BCA or the Employment Conditions Commission advises the minister to increase that threshold, then it will also apply in terms of this provision, because we are not putting the amount, we are just saying that everybody that earns equal to the threshold or below will be allowed to take any discrimination case to the CCMA for arbitration, not only for conciliation, to give the vulnerable workers that we know that the most vulnerable ones that are discriminated on this daily basis access to justice. Because the law currently requires that the CCMA does conciliate. And if you still agree, then you need to actually go to the labor court. Most people drop their cases of unfair discrimination because they don't have means and resources to pay lawyers to take their cases further to the labor court. Hence, also at the CCMA, we are not finding many cases of unfair discrimination. And we are hoping that with this amendment, we'll be able to see more people being afforded the opportunity to exercise their constitutional rights of equality. There was a comment also from the Honourable Member on the enforcement mechanism. The organized business, we're all shocked that they actually want to protect people that don't want to comply with the law. Because an e-plan is a roadmap, like I said. They always have business strategies and business plans. They set targets on a daily basis of where they want to drive their organizations. And we are saying you need your human resources, these are people, to achieve your own business targets that you want to achieve. Therefore, you need more diversified workforce that will reflect the demographics or the population of this country for us to sustain our economy and complement each other in terms of our skills and knowledge. I don't know. I think you've covered all the areas, Chairperson. Thank you.
I think just to indicate, thank you for those responses. Just to indicate that the report, both this report and the report that will be getting later on, is for us to be able to engage with the submissions which will be made. Some of these questions will still be conversed with the people who will be making the submissions. We have received the summaries of the submission, so this is quite a helpful background. I still maintain that the question of value is a very philosophical question, from whichever way you want to look at it, and especially if we want to get into anecdotes, then we'll make it even worse. But I think what we want to appreciate, or rather what we will accept as not a definition, but an explanation of what we mean is in relation to the conventions which we have adopted as an expression of what will be in law. I think we must just leave it at that. That's what we're going to be following. The rest of the other things, when in school, as recent as I was in school, people were allocated into classes on the basis of how clever they are, and not on the it was not a random thing. So a teacher who caught standard 9E knew that they got a group of not very clever people. As compared to 9A, for instance. So now how do you compensate? Obviously the 9E chap, if he has to get 100%, it will be more value, or rather it will be more work required to turn around. So that's what I'm saying. It still remains a very philosophical question, which I don't think that we need to get into. So with that, I think let's close with the employment equity, and let's get the correct report on the employment services.
Whether the scheme has possible
that does not happen, and whether the employment services board will have the capacity to make decisions on them.
Framework that will coordinate the process.
Now, there is an agreement around the importance of having a provision around intervening in companies in distress. But the issues of this agreement centers around issues such as who decides as to whether a company is in distress or not. Because some companies can easily, during the negotiations, plead poverty, basically argue that they've run at the losses, when on the other hand, companies have awarded, for instance, huge bonuses to their employees, etc. And trade unions were basically saying, unless there are principles that are either set at NEDLAC labor market chamber level, the ES board may not be the appropriate forum to determine those kind of principles, etc. So again, the issue was whether certain aspects of job retention and enterprise scheme should be left at the level of the Employment Services Board, or others should be elevated to NEDLAC.
Just to ask you, and my apologies for another disruption, just to ask you, because there was concern around following these agreements, maybe if you could take it from why are we having this bill being introduced, the objectives and all of that, and then let's see how far we can go with that. This may save us time, but we may end up having to spend a lot more time in the future having to explain everything else. If we can promise that we're going to somewhere around the world.
I'm not sure if honourable members have copies of the bill itself, because that would also assist. Otherwise, I would. The presentation was basically. If we can go back to slide number one, on the objectives of the bill, we did not go into detail because we assumed that during the last briefing. We actually did the overall framework. But there are
if you can just take us through the slides as quickly as you can, just for the benefit of the honorable members who are not present at that meeting.
Okay, sure. Okay. Thank you, honorable chairperson. I think the objectives of this Employment Services Bill and detailed in Section 2 of the Act itself basically has to deal with, firstly, the challenge that the Department of Higher Education and the Department of Labor had when the president decided to separate the employment services functions to remain within the Department of Labor on one hand, and secondly, the skills development to go to the Department of Higher Education. Honorable members will remember that when the Manpower Training Act that was repealed and the Career Guidance and Placement Act 1981 that were repealed, and the Skills Development Act was passed, some aspects of the two legislation were incorporated into a single legislation called the Skills Development Act. Hence, we had Employment and Skills Development Services governed under a single legislation. And with the separation, what the president did and the legal people that worked with us was to clearly demarcate those aspects that should go and those that should remain. And what we ended up was with a lacuna where, for instance, the Skills Development Act presidency, the instructors that we should, as early as 2009-10, try and fix that problem, hence the proposals of this bill in 2009 and the initial publication in 2010 to try and deal with that problem that existed. But secondly, we wanted to provide a legal framework for the functioning of the risk position public employment services, and thirdly, to provide for a legal basis for the establishment and functioning of Productivity SA and protected employment enterprises. This has been a big issue because the factory, Productivity SA, at least the section in total, has been transferred from the Skills Development Act to the Employment Services Bill, whilst the sheltered employment factories have been operating under a cabinet decision that goes back to as early as 1948. And the issue has been the legal basis within which these factories are operating. And this issue has been a major one with the AG that we need to provide legal basis for the establishment of this factory. So that's section 2 and 3 basically deals with the purpose. In the main, through public employment services, in a number of other countries and the legislation that we have seen when we talk about the reposition public employment services, fundamentally in section 2 is that you improve access to labor market for work seekers, provide opportunities for new entrants to labor market to gain work experience, and improve the employment prospects of work seekers, etc. So that section really outlines those functions. And three, six, the definitions are also clearly outlined, and we've gone extensively through the interpretation and definition so that there's no confusion in terms of the Act. And again, that is why we're saying that section and there was unanimous agreement with the social partners. The purpose of the Act, I think I've already outlined that everybody, I mean, in this case, what we did was to take about 7 conventions from the ILO that guided and informed the actual drafting of this legislation. There's a convention on private employment agencies, how you deal with them, certain minimum standards, a convention on factories or special employment for people with disability, a convention on employment services, and so on. Now, those were some of the conventions that we basically distributed to social partners, because they are part of the network process. They are very familiar with those conventions, and they use the conventions to check the extent to which we were able to embrace those principles. And we believe that with the passage of the Act, it will then pave, for instance, South Africa's route towards ratifying those conventions, because we have embraced the spirit of those conventions in the legislation. So all those sections covering the purpose of the Act were actually agreed to at length. The interpretation, I think, goes with definitions. I'll skip that. Now, on the functions of the public employment services, there was also unanimous agreement, and Chapter 2 of the Act in the main outlines the public employment services functions, and this is functions that are performed by ministries of labor, employment, and social development throughout the world, basically that of matching the there are differences between those that have training component, those that without training. But there is, in most cases, consistency in terms of this kind of function. And there is a body that governs public employment services, WAPES, the World Association of Public Employment Services, which basically determines standards and so on. And we believe that in the research that we conducted, undertaken by the University of Cape Town and Chidinma Thompson in terms of legislation, we're able to broadly cover those core functions. Some go beyond what we have, but in the main, the critical ones, believe that we're able to embrace them as outlined in Section 5. And social partners agree to those. We could have gone beyond this, but there are extensive costs involved when you start taking a number of other functions. For instance, if I can give you an example around critical support that is offered to work seekers to enter into employment in terms of startup capital. Other countries have resources that are given to new people who enter into employment in terms of relocation. For instance, when they relocate from their area of residence to the other area, in terms of transport coverage, in terms of housing, in terms of equipment that they need to start life in a completely different environment. Now, those are things that are done by advanced economies. Now, we felt that, you know, as the economy improves and over the years we'll get there, but we could not include some of those aspects because they would have had very, very serious financial implications. At the goal, they remain critical. We discuss them in treasury, but some of those things got dropped during the drafting process. But we maintain the core that we believe we could go with, and Section 5 was agreed to in total by the stakeholders. On the promotion of employment of youth and vulnerable work seekers. Now, this is the section where I started off in terms of disagreement. I think, Honorable Chair, everybody agrees that during economic downturn, in areas of high unemployment rate and so on, countries such as India, etc., with 1.3 billion population and only 10% formal employment, a lot of schemes have been introduced, MREGA, the Mahatma Gandhi 100 day guarantee schemes, and a whole range of them, and I don't think we are that far off in South Africa. We have our own PWP, etc. And the issue in terms of labor activation programs centers around issues such as the selection process, the determination of income levels, whether the scheme has displacement effect to existing workers or not, issues around conditions of employment, etc. Now, the disagreement at NEDLEC basically was that we all agree with the schemes. However, there are certain critical aspects that must be decided at NEDLEC level because they are of measure policy implication, and those cannot be left to the employment services board. So the issue was more around the mechanics of, or that is the level of distinguishing issues firstly, and whether the appropriate forum to which decisions on certain issues could be taken on the employment services board or the election. The second one, Honorable Chairperson, dealt with the retention schemes. Now, Section 7 of the bill talks to retention schemes. Now, the schemes are basically those measures that you introduce in companies that are in distress. The training thereof was a very good example. And the challenge has been that there is no legislative framework in all labor legislation that governs the process. Even though we had a global agreement to respond to recession, what this section does is that it actually aims to formalize that process so that we can have a proper coordination. Now, again, nobody disagrees with the need for intervention. The issues that arose at NEDLEC was, what is the firstly distinguishing certain aspects of the scheme, and I can give you a very good example that we experienced during the training thereof, which has also contributed towards the current failure in some of them. Some companies will simply come and say, we're in distress, we want government money, and unless we get that money, we're going to retrench workers. Now, we put the onus on the company to prove that they're in distress. Now, it's not an easy issue. We invited NEDLEC, the CCMA, to facilitate that process, because CCMA then says, bring your books and companies will then use confidentiality of information as an excuse not to bring books. But then, and trade unions on the other hand will come to you and say, no, but we have proved that X bonuses have been awarded to the top management and we don't agree with the argument that the company is in distress. Because only when they open their books we can then determine whether they're in distress or not. So NEDLEC, I mean, what the social partners were saying was that we should be able to say on some of these aspects, the policy or guidelines will be determined at NEDLEC level, and on certain aspects, those things will be determined at the employment services board level. So again, the issue was the level of the structure. Section 8 deals with the whole question of employment of foreign nationals. Now, every country has procedures that they use, and increasingly, I think between Home Affairs ourselves and international organizations managing migration such as IOM, the United Nations, there's an agreement that migration is becoming much more of a labor issue. People live where they were born to go to other countries in search of better prospects of living. So it has moved beyond just an issue around tourism to issues of survival. And increasingly, even Home Affairs is saying Department of Labor should play a major role. Now, there are differences between migration in terms of areas where you have high levels of skilled people coming to the country and low levels of people. I mean, like in the current situation within the SADC countries, South Africa is a major receiving country in terms of lower level skills coming into the country. And how you manage the two is a labor migration policy matter. And I think there was an agreement that we need to manage this issue because it has a potential of exploding in our face. And there was an agreement around the section around how we should actually go about managing migration. On reporting on vacancies and filling of positions, and this was linked to the whole question of placement. Now, some countries compel companies to report on vacancies that they have in order to allow the matching processes to happen. And the initial formulation said companies must. Now, during the real process, this issue came up to say that if you compel companies to register vacancies, you may end up with a lot of court cases, and you may end up involved in a whole range of breaches in terms of administration, and that we needed to, whilst everybody understands that, you know, if you are to really make a difference in terms of matching unemployed with vacancies that exist, somebody needs to know where those vacancies exist. But the principle of being compelled to report on those vacancies is what employers were not necessarily happy with. And the resolution that was proposed, which was a bit of a compromise, was that we should change the must to may. And that allowed basically the minister to also reserve the right where the minister realizes that there is no movement to also introduce measures and to specify categories within which companies can actually or must report such vacancies. But still, even though we thought that we were going to reach agreement on that compromise, business was still of the view that the administrative procedures in relation to that section is something that we need to actually look at. On employment services information, this has mainly to do with the whole question of information of individuals, because honorable members may know that in the environment where people are desperate for employment, they entrust, for instance, private information to private employment agencies, and this information can end up being abused in the process, and in some instances it can lead to all sorts of trafficking and all that. Now, there was unanimous agreement on certain standards that we must actually observe when it comes to the handling and management of information of individuals. On financing of public employment services, again, it's basically how you fund activities of public employment services. The section makes reference to allocation from the state, but insofar as programs that are embarked upon, for instance, assist retrenched workers, it makes reference to the UIF funding such programs insofar as they relate to COIDA for the compensation fund to come in at that level. And again, there was an agreement. In fact, business wanted to also introduce a provision for registration of private employment agencies that the money is then reallocated in terms of enforcement of this provision, because they are also quite aware of the fact that there are a lot of temporary employment agencies or private employment agencies that are currently operating and in the process damaging the good work of duly registered public employment agencies. So, on the board members, there was an agreement on this one. On the private employment, that is the private employment services, the registration licensing processes, and how we go about licensing and deregistering private employment agencies, there was agreement on that. On the prohibited act by private employment agencies, we have a list that is clearly outlined even in Schedule 3. There was an agreement on this act. There was an issue though around how the inspectors should actually go about enforcing this, because what we have done in the field is that insofar as enforcing the basic conditions of the Employment Act applies, but the issue was much more around the point that I'm going to talk to. On the charging of fees by private employment agencies, there was a unanimous agreement on that issue, except that the business basically wanted us to clarify services. And if I can just give an example, the ILO convention says you can't charge, and I think everyone agrees, but business will say, insofar as other levels of work seekers are involved and categories of work seekers are involved, maybe we need to clarify that aspect. A good example would be like football players, it would be like actors, it would be like drivers in sports racing, etc. Because the argument is that as the agent, they negotiate the contract on behalf of the player, and therefore they are entitled to a proportion of the income of that player, and because that's how they make their money, and if they are excluded and they are forced to charge the provider, for instance, if an agent has a colleague who's a good good football player for Kaiser Chiefs or for Pirates and so on, the agent, the agent must then negotiate their fee for placement from Kaiser Chiefs or instead of taking a cut on
Years of protection of the church.
Okay. So those were the issues that they said we needed to look at. On the retention of information that was agreed to for work seekers, on the cancellation of registration of private employment agencies, this is in those instances where they don't comply, there was an agreement. On the establishment of the Employment Services Board, including its composition and the work that it should do, there was an agreement, save for those areas where I said that between business and labor, there was a feeling that where certain aspects may be of a policy nature or may require or may impact on the broader society, before the Employment Services Board makes the necessary regulation, they should also consult NEDLAC. I think business argument was that the composition of the board is determined at the NEDLAC level. And I think the challenge with all the constituencies has to do with the competency and the quality of people and the commitment level that you put in the trust of people that are nominated by that structure to serve as the Employment Services Board, and also the vigilance that they need to retain on certain aspects at the higher structure on certain matters that may be of a policy nature at the management level. But so far as the functions were concerned, there was an agreement. The composition, there was an agreement. Functions, there was an agreement. The secretariat of the board, there was an agreement. Employment growth and productivity. In fact, this is already low in terms of the Skills Development Act. So negotiations were very kind of academic, because that section is being moved as it is from the current Skills Development Act to the Employment Services, and the president also promotion of protected work for persons with disabilities, there was an agreement on that issue at national level and the need for the legal framework. And the jurisdiction of the labor court, there was overall agreement. The monitoring and enforcement, because this is in line with the basic conditions of employment, we didn't create a parallel enforcement process. There was an agreement on that. Offences, there was an agreement on that. And in the on the fines and the delegations, and if I can just come to the regulations around Section 40. Now, Section 40, the initial draft that we had, although made reference to Section 40, in the issue that they were referring to is what is in terms of the current bill in Section 52, that is 49 and Section 50, sorry, Section 49, 2 and Section 50. But this was addressed because initially the sections were not synchronized. The one issue had to do with the fines that can be imposed by the court on representation by the director general. Now, if you look at, if honorable members look at Section 49.2 and Schedule 3, it adequately addresses the problem that was identified. And Section 50 deals with those offences wherein the labour court can impose a, you know, a sentence that could be a prison term and a fine or both. And the issue that was raised at NEDLEC was an issue of synergizing, which the drafters and the state law advisors in the final bill adequately addressed. And if I can just give a summary on the book, Chairperson. In terms of Section 1 to 18, there was overall agreement. 19 to 89 and Schedule 2 in terms of transitional provisions, there was an agreement. The areas that I was talking to where there were disagreements relate to those sections that are under Section 6.1, 7.1, 10, 13, 15, parts of 19 and 40, which is basically in terms of the bill 49 and 50. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Welcome, Honorable Mukerba. Yes, thank you for joining us. Thanks. No, we welcomed you when you went out to get called. To go and confirm that we all accept the free and peaceful elections. Yeah, okay. Honorable A. William. Thank you, Chairperson. I've got a serious problem with this report. On the areas of disagreement, it talks to point Section 13 and Section 19. But if you look at the report on the pages where those sections were highlighted, it says that they were agreed. So I'd just like to know if there's this huge contradiction, if it's possible for this committee to get the actual report from NEDLAC so they can actually really see what was agreed and what wasn't agreed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine is in the presentation, and when you look at the line-up of the sections, it's always the case that the issue of people with disability will feature at the end of anything that we do. really an issue for Asia that people with disabilities, they are not necessarily regarded as people as equal to any other person. And that's what we wanted to raise, that was, you look at any legislation, at any program, it will be this and people with disabilities, this and people with disabilities. It's always the case. Other sectors are prioritized, even in this presentation, in the lining of the sections. That was the bottom, meaning that they will only be entertained after all other sectors have been attended to. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Are there any other further questions, further observations? Thank you. Mr. Morotoba.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. If I can go to the report that was sent from NEDLEC, the original report, Honorable Member, on page 21 of that report, the original report sent by NEDLEC, on page 21, it does say registration and licensing of private employment agencies, section 31. 13.1 to 13.8 was agreed. I must also indicate in terms of the report and maybe I need to have a little clarity because no, this was an omission on our part, Honorable Chairperson. The section 13 should not have been included in that list as area of disability. I accept the problem on this slide, on the summary slide. But the original agreement, 13 on page 21, it's one of those types of things that came in to the list. Now, Honorable Nyakemba, the two sections which were set to,
it was 13 and 19,
which is highlighted as disagreement, but in the presentation it says agreed. Now, I must also indicate, Honorable Chairperson, that the numbering of the final bill and the original bill that was used as a basis for negotiation at NEDLEC, there were slight changes. On page 23 of the original NEDLEC report, on the cancellation and registration of private employment agency. The issue, maybe the reason why we also included it there was that from labor side, government, labor and business, there was agreement. However, the issue more was the drafters who had to deal with the legal component in terms of the drafting, and this is one area where we anticipate that we believe that they've done a lot of work to try and clarify. But the issue, if honourable members can go to the last column of that report on the consolidated summary, it says no consensus drafters to advise on legal status, and subsequent to that they've done that, and again it's one of those areas that we put in here, but in terms of the essence of the content of the bill, there was agreement. Okay.
Don't have to, issue here is that we all agree on the provision, and Sam is saying that it was a mistake that we did not agree. But the business had a concern that, remember, when a register deregister these organizations, it's unlike deregistering a trade union. You deregister a company, basically. And when you deregister, it means you can't operate. Business, then the concern is that of business, that if they apply for a review of that decision not to deregister should stand so that the company can continue operation. That was their concern that you were raising. It's not about the section itself, it's about the effect of the deregistration and the effect of the review when they apply. And now, the issue is that the LRA as the business, if you look at the report from NetLink, Labour says, well, the LRA deals with this issue of deregistration, what happens when you deregister? And if you allow a company that is deregistered to operate, the chances of workers in that company getting their rights are affected by that issue of deregistration. And that was the issue. The act as it says, the section as it says, is not the argument. It's a concern on the effect that business is raising if deregistration does take place. This is about labor broking, basically, because if you look at the LRA says that for labor brokers to operate, they've got to be registered in terms of an applicable legislation. And that applicable legislation is this legislation. And now if you deregister, then in that, even if it's not labor broking, if you deregister, the impact of that business are great. That's the issue. But the principles are great.
All right, next. Okay. I think Honorable members' issue. Maybe I think it deals with the location of the chapter and the bank. Now, I mean, I don't think the spirit within which the section was allocated was mainly to put it at the back as such, because if honourable members can go to the temples etc., disability features right through. It's just that the section had to be, I mean, in our discussion with the lawyers in terms of the establishment, because the beneficiaries of this bill are youth, are retrenched workers, are work seekers, irrespective of whether they are disabled or not, and all that. The section in terms of the establishment of protected employment factories to deal with the legislative vacuum that has been in existence for years. Granted, it's at the back, but I don't think it was intentional or mainly suggesting that disabilities, people with disabilities should actually be looked down upon. Such I would welcome any suggestions that one of the members can actually put forward in terms of the repackaging of the chapter. But, and when we were discussing both productivity and establishment of that is employment services board, the protected employment sectors and productivity okay. That issue came up and the lawyers basically said that it makes sense if you synchronize them in this fashion. I don't think the intention was ever to suggest that disability issues come last. Maybe I may have got the impression, but certainly it was never the intention.
This section is about the establishment of sheltered employment factories. That's what this section is about. And also, it's also a transfer No, it's not a transfer only thing. It's because children's employment sector present, there's no law that set them up. We have to have the law so that we can campaign effectively for funding from National Treasury. And that's what we're doing to put it in. And the synchronization is that you have a board. Maybe we could have put productivity South Africa before that, the shared employment. But in the slide, it does not say the setting up of the shared employment factory. It says dealing with disability, but the section mainly is about that.
Okay. All
right. Good luck. Thank you, Chair. I'm Chair, State Government Health Office. I'm trying to add a little issue, Chair, on this concern raised by the honourable member about the location of the disability provisions. Chair, what I would like to say is that the legal effect of these provisions, Chair, wherever they are allocated, Chair, are the same as the other provisions that may be at the beginning or rather at the middle of the bill, Chair. Member Chair, it is exactly the same as the other provision. It's legal effect when Parliament passes this bill, Chair, and it becomes an act of Parliament. Therefore, the disability provisions, or rather people who are disabled, equally protected by the law, Chair. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but I mean, we can equally say that it actually even make the question to arise as to why then put certain sections at 1 and certain sections at 40. I think your response is actually making this whole discussion more problematic. If all the sections are equal, why even number them? In fact, I think it's a very arrogant response. Okay, all right. Anyway, Honorable Putau?
Yeah, just a quick one to align myself with what Honorable Kendra has done. What is really done is to say to ourselves, people with disabilities are people. They can't be an afterthought. That's really what you're saying. And in terms of what to do, they seem to do that. I want to emphasize another point that I've made, because you made a point and I have to mention about this. I truly believe that if we handle this thing correctly, we can ensure in this country that people with disabilities, especially those who can speak, do something, can be fully employed. This is the impact. I think this is the essence of what we're trying to do, and I think we should focus on that.
Honorable Nkemba?
Thank you, sir. I think we understand the legislation. I think we're over it. It's not that we don't know that. But the issue here is that we are members of Parliament. And we are dealing with a number of associations. And one of these associations that we are dealing with is Disabled People of South Africa. So who raised this issue? This issue is not coming from NEGAP. I think it must be understood that we are not just raising an issue, we represent the voters here. I wanted that to be clear, adding to what you said. The second point for me, sir, is the private employment agencies or services. Vis-a-vis the amendments of the Labour Relations Act. And what I just want to establish is during the process, the deadline processes, was not taken into account that these amendments which have some kind of formulation vis-a-vis now the private employment agencies that reflect in this bill. I know that you are linking it even to the ILO conventions, and I think at the same time, even
the manner in which we have dealt with those amendments, that aspect, it was also linked to that. I just wanted to check that. Not to debate it, what is my view, what is the Honorable A. William L. U. Thank you, sir.
Yes, you must not forget your S.
Thank you. I'm